Good morning. We're going to have Jim lead us in prayer before we begin this morning. Amen. Good to see everybody here this morning. We're thankful for the visitors. We are a smaller crowd than normal, with it being the tail end of spring break. People still out. Missing Chuck this morning. Jonathan, is your mother with him?
No, she's here.
Okay. So we're missing Chuck anyway, as he's laboring in a gospel meeting in Texas. Grateful for everybody's attendance. We're studying from 1 Corinthians, for those that are visiting with us. Our goal has been for a year now to begin with Genesis and go to Revelation, studying one book of each week of the Bible, doing a summary of that. So we fly. We move pretty quickly through these particular books, really to give more of the background of it, hoping that everybody's reading as we go along. You'll not get nearly as much from it if you are not. But we today study from 1 Corinthians, and I will say that, you know, the foundation for the epistles is in the book of Acts, and understanding Acts is extremely important in trying to help us to really get a handle on particularly the letters written by Paul and the churches that were established along the journeys, as we talked about when we were studying Acts. So we begin today with one of those letters that Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians. So if you look at Acts chapter 18, 1 through 17, and I've got it on the board, you can turn there if you'd like, or just read with me on the board. This is the start of the church of Corinth. In Acts 17, you've just seen the scene in Athens where Paul stood on the Areopagus and had his discussion or debate with the people there about worshiping an unknown God. And from Athens, Paul tells us, or Luke records for us, after this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. And he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, recently come from Italy, with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. And he went to see them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and worked, for they were tent makers by trade. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and tried to persuade Jews and Greeks. When Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, Paul was occupied with the word, testifying to the Jews that the Christ was Jesus. And when they opposed and reviled him, he shook out his garments and said to them, "Your blood be on your heads. I'm innocent. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." And he left there and went to the house of a man named Titus Justus, a worshiper of God. His house was next door to the synagogue. Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed in the Lord, together with his entire household. And many of the Corinthians, hearing Paul, believed and were baptized. And the Lord said to Paul one night in a vision, "Do not be afraid, but go on to speaking, and do not be silent. For I am with you, and one will attack you to harm you, and no one will attack you to harm you. For I have many in this city who are my people." To any of this, and he stayed a year and 6 months teaching the word God among them. But when Gallo was proconsul of Achaia, The Jews made a united attack on Paul and brought him before the tribunal, saying, "This man is persuading people to worship God contrary to the law." But when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallo said to the Jews, "If it were a matter of wrongdoing or vicious crime, O Jews, I could have reason to accept your complaint. But since it is a matter of questions about words and names and your own law, see to it yourselves. I refuse to be a judge of these things." And he drove them from the tribunal, and they all seized Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue, and beat him in front of the tribunal. But Gallo paid no attention to any of this. And that's all there is in actually the church beginning in Corinth. Look especially where I have highlighted verse 8, Crispus being a first known convert at Corinth, the ruler of the synagogue who believed the Lord together with his entire household. And many of the Corinthians hearing Paul believed and were baptized. So it's there that we see the church at Corinth being established. When we look at our template that Swindell gives us and we each week, and we modify it some occasionally, we see, as we just read from Acts 18, is a recording of the church at the beginning of Corinth. The book is written from Ephesus, we think, probably about 55 to 56 A.D. Now, I'm going to say this probably every week. I'm not stuck on these dates. These are all circa. You know, who knows whether this is the exact date of this. And I think getting adamant as if we know is a mistake when we're talking about the dates. Not so much important the date, maybe as the time period that we're talking about and the impact of the particular area or period of time that we're talking about. So as we see up here, beginning of chapter 1, verses 1 through 9, is the introduction of the book, as Paul commonly does. He introduces. The conclusion happens in chapter 16, verses 10 through 24. And between that, we have a section from chapter 1, 10 through chapter 6 about the rebuke for sinful conditions. We'll talk a lot some more about this as we go through our outline. There he begins the divisions of the church, key verse being in verse 10, "I appeal to you, brothers, that all of you agree there be no divisions among you." It's God's intention. And Paul's exclamation and exhortation that that be the case. Should be the case here. Should be the case everywhere. That we understand the importance of not being divided, of having unity. And then in this section, in chapter 1:10 through 4:21, Swindell tells us that it has to do much with the divisions in the church that took place there. Paul's exhortation to them, the explanation and exposition. Chapters 5 through 6, the disorders in the church, the moral disorder involving the man who was involved in a relationship with his father's wife, incest that's there, the fornication, the moral disorder in chapter 5, legal disorder in chapter 6, and carnal disorder in chapter 6 is 12 through 20. And then a reply to specific questions in chapter 7, verse 1, we learn the fact that the church of Corinth had sent Paul some questions, and they were delivered to him. And when they were delivered to him, he deals with, in his writing, some of the difficulties they were having in church involving things like marriage or the domestic relationship, things involving social liberties, and spends some time defending his apostleship in that section. Ecclesiastical, specifically some things involving about doing things decently in order, he says, that God is not the author of division, and deals with the specifics of the woman's place as it relates to all this in the worship. And then some practical things involving the miraculous gifts, the arguments that they were have. One of the things they were divided over in large part is you weren't satisfied with the gift that you were given, so you wanted somebody else's gift. And particularly as it related to the gift of tongues. Like many today, they became confused over the whole idea of gifts anyway, but they still desired what they did not have. And what they did not have caused them to divide with brothers. And then things involving the death, burial, and resurrection, what he refers to as doctrinal, very important section of Scripture. I can't spend time on all this. Obviously, I hope you've read it. and then some things involving the church and its giving and concerning the collection of the saints in 1 Corinthians 16, verses 1 and 2. And then, as we said, the conclusion of the text. So, the specific questions that are covered from chapters 7:1 through chapter 16:9. And the idea of exhortation and involving some things about which they had written to him about or questions that they had, emphasis on the unity of the body and the clarity of these six things that we talked about up here, the importance of understanding the Christian's conduct in the church. That really kind of sets us up as what we are to talk about this morning. In the chart that we continue to look at, the periods or dispensations, I commend Ken for catching that we had at the bottom here for some time right there from ascension to the death of Paul. That's actually inaccurate. He's right on about that. It would be from the ascension to the death of John in 98 AD when he finally dies somewhere during that period of time. So that's the period we are. That's the period of the church, what we refer to as we've talked about the last days from Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 and 2 and other passages. There we are. This is the canon and its order. This is approximately when it's written. Look how close all these dates are. Do you know why? I don't know. Here is Hester over here. And so he just basically puts dates that he thinks are approximate in nature. These are somewhere around this date. So I'm not going to have any disagreement with that. I will tell you that 2 Corinthians was written probably from Macedonia, and it was written a short time period after he had written 1 Corinthians from Ephesus. He goes over to Macedonia, and doesn't take long at all when he learns from Titus about the condition of the church in 1 Corinthians, where he was waiting to hear about the information. He gets good news from Titus, and so he writes the second letter, 2 Corinthians. We'll talk about that next week. So there it is. It's one of the letters of Paul. There's two letters of Corinthians. Corinth is right there. This is the third missionary journey where he starts in Antioch. And we travel. We talked about this when we just studied Acts. Comes over to Corinth, and then he retraces his steps and ends up in Jerusalem, where he ends up awaiting actually his transportation travel to Rome, where he'll later be imprisoned. So this is the area that we're talking about. Notice the isthmus right here. This little piece of land, you see the dot, that's Corinth. And that was critical to the success, the business success, the financial success. They were well known. We'll talk and read some about that as we continue. So when you hear any references to the isthmus, that's what it's talking about. And it gave them a fair advantage as it related to travelers who were coming through that particular area. So this is what we had when we were doing our studying the book of Acts. You'll see here in the second missionary journey, this is when Paul made his trip. We just read about it in Acts 18. And then later on, he writes from Ephesus about AD 56, the letter of 1 Corinthians. Below that, a few months later, probably, certainly not long after that, he travels to Macedonia and he writes 2 Corinthians. All right? So here's an introduction that I pulled from Eflagard Smith. Y'all know it probably that Nancy and I, we move back and forth right now. We're studying again, reading again daily, almost daily, often as we can, from the narrated Bible by Eflagard Smith. It's a chronological Bible. So rather than going Genesis to Revelation in the canon like we typically, I show on the left side of our chart, it takes it more from the viewpoint of the time frame in which it was written. It's interesting to read it that way. So we enjoy that. So right now we're doing that. I already finished the New Testament and we've started on the Old Testament once again. All right. So here's what Eflagard Smith says about it, beginning here. Luke does not indicate how long Paul stays in Antioch after returning from his second missionary journey. Now, we got that in our heads. But it is probably not long before Paul is once again preparing for an extended evangelistic tour. He begins his third tour by passing north and west through Galatia and Phrygia. It is clear that Paul continues to be concerned about the spiritual growth of those whom he had converted several years earlier. Paul then travels on through Asia to its capital, Ephesus. We looked at that on the map a little while ago. And thereby fulfills the desire he felt first on his second tour when he was directed by the Holy Spirit to Macedonia instead. It appears that Paul relishes the opportunity to be in this important city because he stays here for approximately 3 years. Of special significance during this time are letters which Paul writes to the church at Corinth, the church which has developed some serious problems since Paul visited them. So whether it was Ephesus or Macedonia from where these letters were written, some debate. But anyway, that's a decent introduction to the book. I always need to remember to shut down the internet here. Okay. Giving me flashbacks. Excuse me. You hear it, don't you? All right, I think that did it. So here's some things about the city of Corinth. I just thought I would put these up for us real quickly. I think it's kind of important for us to know a little bit about the city as Paul writes the church. It's called the Light of Greece by Cicero, the historian. It was the capital city of the Roman province Achaia and surpassed all other cities of the ancient world in political and commercial importance. It was well known for its strength and for its economic prosperity. Corinth was situated on the isthmus. I just showed you that, the narrow land bridge which connects the Peloponnese Peninsula with the rest of the mainland of Greece. On the east was the Aegean Sea, and on the west was the Adriatic Sea. Traffic from both north and south of Greece had no alternative but to pass through this area because south of Corinth was the most dangerous cape of the Mediterranean. So it was a key city. Corinth had a reputation for being impregnable because it was located at the foot of Acrocorinth, where at the top of the mountain one could see for miles. The top was said to be some 2,000 feet above sea level. Known to be full of culture and influence, distinguished for its learning and refinement, Corinth was a melting pot of people from all parts of the world, a population of over 400,000, that's a guess. At this time, the fourth largest city in the Roman Empire, following Rome, Alexandria, and Antioch. During Paul's time, Corinth was a Greco-Roman city, a Roman city with Greek influence, Hellenistic influence, and was known for its literature and its athletic events as the best of the Isthmus Games. New Testament often refers to things involving the crown or the race, as it does in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, 24 through 27. An obvious inference as it relates to the Corinth, who are well aware of this particular affair that went on each year at the Greco, where the gladiator games were played. Corinth was also known for its wickedness and became a byword for evil and immoral living. You would think of it in the terms of Las Vegas during this period of time. The temple of Venus, a Roman name, or Aphrodite, the Greek name, was there, referred to as, it was known to be the goddess of love, where prostitution was carried in the name of religion, often frequently. Happened even at the temple itself. They were calling evil good and good evil, Isaiah 5:20. Sound like anybody, you know. Even so, a church was established, and it was a hotbed of vice, chapter 6, 9 through 10, those listings of sins they were involved. Good thing is that Paul does mention they were washed, and they put themselves back in appropriate relationship with God. But there was a lot of misconduct during this time. Caught up in their own wisdom, no wonder they considered the gospel foolish. And you'll remember Paul saying, for after that, in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God. It pleased God by the foolishness of preaching, or saying in chapter 3 and verse 19, that God taketh up the wise his own craftiness. These people were full of vanity. From his letters to the Corinthians, Paul writes to a church comprised largely of Gentile and Greek members. As new members of Christ, they bring with them their pagan and cultural influence, such as glorifying wisdom and ecstatic utterances, eating meat offered to idols, promiscuity, and the denial of bodily resurrection. The Roman Greek society permitted prostitution, and the legal process of taking disputes to the city magistrate was customary. Knowing the evil that was there, and the affluence of the nation, the area, the improper perspective involving wisdom, no wonder Paul would say, evil companionship corrupts good morals. Be careful who you hang with. And this is a principle that is not just introduced in 1 Corinthians 14. We know about this from the beginning of time. We learned about that back during the time of Sodom and Gomorrah, what evil companionship will do. We know what it means to be in a situation where we're marrying Canaanite women because of the influence that's involved in that. We know all that. We read all that. But how do we do in applying it? Who do we hang with? Who do we spend our time with? How much do we allow the influence of the world to affect us? Where's our engagement from time to time? How often, how frequently are we with people of like precious faith? Who do we hang with, again, is the idea. So that's an issue these people had. And Paul's telling them, if you want to avoid all this, if you want to get away from all this, then watch who your friends are. You know, be careful who you marry. All right, so who wrote the book? We do this every week. Paul had established the church at Corinth in Acts 18:8, and after about 3 months, Silas and Timothy joined him. We just read about this. He found there Priscilla and Aquila. After Paul left, Apollos went to Corinth and met with unusual success in preaching the gospel. Divisions arose in the church because some were glorying in the men and following after them instead of Christ. See that dealt with specifically in chapter 1. Apollos must have had some kind of strong influence on them during this period of time. And Paul showed some disdain for that particular interest in trying to worship men instead of the Lord. Paul's authorship of this epistle is widely accepted in the scholarly community, though it was not the first letter Paul wrote to the Corinthian people. See 1 Corinthians 5:9, where Paul would say there, it's been reported, actually been reported to me. There was a letter before 1 Corinthians, and that's what you're going to see as we continue. We know that the Corinthians mentioned an earlier letter from Paul from chapter 5, 10 through 11, though that letter has not survived. Therefore, it's Paul's second letter of the Corinthians that we know as 1 Corinthians, the first letter of the Corinthians that God inspired. 4 years prior to writing the letter, we know as 1 Corinthians, the apostle had spent 18 months in Corinth, so he was intimately familiar with the church. Paul's concern for the church and the effect of the letter mattered to him as he awaited Titus to bring word of their condition. When Titus was delayed, Paul set out to meet him at Macedonia, 1 Corinthians 2:13, 7, 5, and verse 13. And when Titus brings the news that all is well, then Paul takes the time to write the 2 Corinthian letter called the Letter of Reconciliation. Very personal letter as we get in the discussion that next week. Where are we? It was likely while Paul was in Ephesus, probably in AD 55-56, that he learned the Corinthian church was involved in a very serious problem, or had very serious problems. Paul had been in Ephesus for more than 2 years on his third missionary journey when he received a disturbing report of quarreling within the church, a report he received from people associated with one of its members, a woman named Chloe, 1 Corinthians 1:11. Stephanus Fortunatus and Acacius came to Ephesus bringing news of the conditions at Corinth in chapter 16, verse 17. We read that. Then we learn also in 1 Corinthians 7:1, which we referred to earlier, that the Corinthian church had sent a letter to Paul in which they had raised a number of questions with which Paul deals with in the letter. Apparently, Paul dispatched the letter with Timothy as the carrier in chapter 4 and verse 17. In short, the church he had founded so recently from Acts 18 had already developed deep divisions, a situation that required immediate action. Paul penned this letter in AD 55-56 just as he was planning to leave Ephesus for Macedonia. So it doesn't take long for us to get in trouble. Long as there's going to be a church, there's going to be people. That's what the church is. As long as you got people, you're going to have challenges. That's the nature of things. If we're looking for a perfect situation, and that's the church we're going to attend, you're never going to find it. Imperfection always exists in churches. And picking up and leaving every time there's a problem is not the answer. Paul never once, not once, did he tell those Corinthian brethren, pick up and leave and go to another church. You know. Now, you may have to do that. I'm not saying that judgment doesn't call for that sometimes in wisdom, but the encouragement I think Paul's giving to us is don't stay where you're at and do what you can to help solve the issues that you have. So why is 1 Corinthians so important? 1 Corinthians contains a frank discussion of the church and the issues that impacted real people in the first century. The Corinthian church was corroded with sin on a variety of fronts. So Paul provided an important model for how the church should handle the problem of sin in its midst. How do you deal with a fornicator? How do you deal with a problem of incest? How do you deal with somebody who's engaged in some kind of public sin? Churches need to pay attention to this. And we don't do it, frankly. We need to love that person enough to do the hard thing and discipline them. That's what it takes to reconcile them to God. We don't need to ignore it, avoid it. Where does that say anywhere in Scripture for us to do that? But that's what we do, generally speaking. We just pretend it's not there. And elders are going to be held accountable for that, by the way. That's part of what they're supposed to be doing, and that's what Scripture clearly tells us, the book of Hebrews, watching out after souls. Watching out after souls is not avoiding, is certainly not avoiding the fact that somebody's in a state of sin. They have a responsibility to deal with it. They have a responsibility to deal with it, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5, because that's what you need to do to keep the leaven out of the church. You need to make sure you keep the problems, that sin, from causing issues in the church itself. It doesn't belong in the church. And so there needs to be a distinction made. You don't do it out of hate. You do it out of love. Love for the church, love for the kingdom, and love for the person's soul. I know it works because in 2 Corinthians, Paul's going to make reference to it. And he's going to tell us that the discipline that they were to take worked. And to be careful not to be too hard on a person who's been forgiven. Once they've repented, let it go. Forgive that person. We'll deal with that some next week. So hard it is, the importance of church discipline toward one involved in immorality should not be minimized. Rather than turn a blind eye toward relational division and all kinds of immorality, Paul addressed the problems head on. In his bold call to purity within the Corinthian church, Paul made it clear that he was willing to risk the good opinion of some in order to help cleanse the sin that tainted the church. So should it be with elders. Also, we should see that problems among us in general are not new or unique. As long as there are people, there are going to be problems. I say this with all love in my heart. I mean, it's not a popularity contest. The elders are required, responsible for the conduct of the congregation in which they rule over. Shepherding involves dealing with sheep when they're sick. And when they're sick, the proper care needs to be given to them. And that sometimes means a harder attention needs to be given to certain situations. Judgment is needed. Wisdom is required. But it needs to be handled. And that's the point of that particular slide. So what's the point? 1 Corinthians addresses reports that Paul received from Chloe's household, as well as a letter he received from the church itself. Let me just stop for a moment before I finish reading that and say, I hear people say that when we take information given to us about the conduct of another church from somebody let's say that Larry comes to Ross and says, you know, I understand that you have a relationship with this particular church. I know some things about them I think you should know. Is that gossip? I would tell you if they're true things, if they're things I need to know about that church, that's exactly what happened here. That the church Paul learned about the condition of that church from the household of Chloe. She reported it to him, and that's what it says. Look at 1 Corinthians 5, verse 1. It was reported to us. So, no, I don't think it always is. I do think we need to be careful about it, but I think there's precedent for it is all I'm trying to help us to see here. So if you have a gospel preacher who's preaching error and somebody says by reputation, hey, do you know before you have that person for a gospel meeting, you might ought to stop and think about that. That's Chloe speaking there. That's somebody who's giving you information that you need to check out and validate. And elders need to listen to that. So in this letter to the church of Corinth, Paul covered a number of different issues related to both life and doctrine, divisions and quarrels, sexual immorality, lawsuits among believers, marriage and singleness, freedom in Christ, order and worship, the significance of the Lord's Supper, and the right use of spiritual gifts. He also included a profound teaching on the resurrection, the line of the thought that joins these topics together with Paul's emphasis on Christian conduct in the local church. The apostle expected that Christian people would live according to Christian ideals, or as he told them, you have been bought with a price, therefore glorify God in your body. Understand your responsibility, each one of us, to be what we ought to be, to help us have unity in church where we're at. So Paul warns them, talks about the sin that was prevalent during that period of time, and it was common among them. And at least some were worse. We just read about it in the book of Acts. And it doesn't matter where you come from, you can be forgiven. But the fact that sin was prevalent in Corinth is the point I'm simply trying to make here as well. The circumstances that prompted the letter, this is basically an outline I took from Harkrider, Robert Harkrider, written on Paul's third missionary journey during the long 3 year at Ephesus, Acts 20 and 32. Number one, this would have been about 3 years after he'd been in Corinth. He had maintained contact with Corinth through letters and friends. The problems at Corinth reflect how a church is affected by culture and association. And the things around us can impact the way we think, you know, the political system that we're under. Often we reflect the leadership of our land as a country. It's so in the church, too, that our elders, when they're too loose on a given thing, the congregation's going to tend to be loose. Dress. If there's never anything said about immodest dress, guess what's going to happen in a church? Evil companionship corrupts good morals. Somebody needs to stand up. And these are lessons that we learned from the church of Corinth, among other things. The reports had become disturbing, thus his letter to address such things, the church had become factious following men. I come not to baptize, Paul said, but to preach the gospel. Now that's a not but statement. He's not de-emphasizing or minimizing the importance of baptism there. Instead, he's enhancing or enlarging the responsibility of preaching. So he's not saying it's not good to baptize. He is saying the more important thing is to preach the gospel. And we're not about throwing people in the water, just dunking them. That's not the idea, Paul says. So he also says that they were puffed up and tolerant of fornication or incest among them in chapter 5. They were contending against one another in a heathen civil court, taking one another court in chapter 6, which was common in the Greco-Roman period during this time. Certainly shouldn't be happening with Christians, and that's Paul's point. He answers questions about marriage. He provided instruction about the eating of meat offered to idols, our responsibility in handling those who are offended by it. The Lord's Supper has become a secular banquet and a scene of dishonor. Paul deals with that. He's not happy at all with how they're conducting themselves that way. They needed instruction regarding spiritual gifts for certain. One of the real problems at the Church of Corinth. And some were denying the doctrine of the resurrection of the dead. Chapter 15 deals with that, often read and often used at funerals, in talking about what happens to us after Christ comes again. Titus is thought to have carried the letter confirming the need of a collection. We read about that in 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2. A couple quotes for you. Dwayne Warden from Truth for Today Commentary says the apostles' longest and most influential letters are Romans and 1 Corinthians. The two are remarkably different in content. Romans is as close as Christians have to a systematic and apostolic presentation of the gospel. 1 Corinthians deals with practical matters of a church struggling to know Christ. Another quote from C.K. Barrett. I believe the church in our generation needs to rediscover the apostolic gospel. And for this it needs the Epistle of Romans. It needs also to discover the relationship between this gospel and its order, discipline, worship, and its ethics. And for this it needs the first epistle to the Corinthians. It matters how we worship God. What kind of person we bring to worship. Here's my brief outline of the book, and it'll be we'll be over the introductions in chapter 1, 1 and 2, the problems in the church needing attention and correction. Wisdom and sectarian strife are incompatible in chapter 1, 4 through 4, 21. The demands of Christ for moral integrity, discipline, and treatment of brethren, chapter 5, 1 through 6, 20. Dealing with the questions of the church, beginning with chapter 7, verse 1, involving marriage and idolatry and spiritual gifts, resurrection of the dead, and then some final matters discussed in 16, 1 through 18. I'd like to conclude with the application from chapter 16, 16 through 13, 16 chapter 13, rather, be on alert or watchful, he says, stand firm in the faith, that vigilance is required to act like men, to have some courage in what we do, to be strong, turn back our back on temptation. A good sermon right there as it relates to our responsibility. Final slide. I might have one more. Paul was compelled by the mission Christ had given the church. Earlier he had said to the Corinthians, "For I preach the gospel that gives me no ground for boasting, for necessity is laid upon me. Woe to me if I preach not the gospel." Chapter 9, verse 16. Still without apology, he leaned on support from the believers in Macedonia. Paul would not accept anything like a salary from the Corinthians. Never did take money from them that we know of. But he appealed to help in carrying out the work of Christ. As has been said many times, some must go and some must send if the gospel of Christ is going to be taken into the world. Paul was highly motivated. He understood that not every Christian would serve the Lord as he did. Not all can or necessarily should leave their homes and trek through the world the way Paul did. All right. So that's all I've got on 1 Corinthians. Did okay. I left a few minutes left for you all to talk, maybe more than normal. So raise your hands and I'll call on you and we'll talk. Yes, sir, brother. Yes, sir.
That's my job. I am going to answer. However, I think that 1 Corinthians, as it is addressed, it's addressed to the Church of God. It's not addressed to the elders of the church.
I agree, absolutely.
And everything in here, I know the elders have got to lead the church in discipline. They need to lead the church in discipline. However, the church was responsible to go to this person.
That's individual, yes.
Yep. And then take witnesses and then
take the elders.
Church.
Yep.
And if I take it to the church, I think it's, they should go to the elders so they can lead that effort and take it into the church. But the church still needs to be involved in that process of discipline and maybe withdrawal from that person. Mm-hmm. Second Corinthians talks about the majority of
Yeah, lawsuit, yeah.
I don't know if the church was involved as a majority to get involved in the restoration of this person. I think that may be where they made the
Yep. I don't mean to cut you off, but I need to tell the people at home what yeah. So for those who are at home, Brother just bringing up the point that it's the church's obligation to get involved in the disciplinary part of it, the elder's job to lead it. And I absolutely concur with that. If you look at Romans 16:17, where Paul talks about, you know, marking them that have, that have caused division among you, or mark them, yeah. But somebody read Romans 16:17. Get it for me so I don't say it wrong. Or Paul's message to the Thessalonian brethren to withdraw from them that walketh disorderly among you. That's the responsibility of the Thessalonican church, the responsibility of the Roman church. Might I also say about, anybody get Romans 16:17? Read it, Jake. Okay. Yeah, they're avoid there, the term there, and also in Thessalonian letter is a nautical term, which means to let your sail in, to withdraw yourself, to take your sail in. Don't accept a brother who's involved in something that this guy was involved in 1 Corinthians 5. It's not going to help him to do that. James would say to save that person from sin, go get him. You know, get after that person. Don't just let him go and drift off into the situation. I might say all about discipline too, and I concur with what he said. It's the church's responsibility before discipline ever occurs. We look at discipline in a negative way, don't we? It's not. Discipline begins on the front end. And how we love somebody will help us in our relationship, developed relationship, to deal with discipline in a better way. I don't know of a case where I've ever been, anyway, and I've served as an elder 3 times, that make me smart, just means I have. But one of the things I do know is discipline works better when the congregation's actively engaged and love that person to begin with. It doesn't do any good at all to withdraw from somebody who doesn't feel loved. I mean, you haven't accomplished anything if the church is not engaged in this process. So places where I've been, where the elders have tried to lead the congregation to do the right thing, to engage and to call and write and pray for this person, to let them know, and they don't do it, how's that going to go? You know, that person's not going to feel a thing whenever the withdrawal actually takes place. Again, I could preach a sermon too, but you're dead on right. I agree with you. Anybody else before we dismiss? Because we're about to be out of time. Yep. Yep.
Of what has been said before. And then, of course, you know, the course of course deals directly with what Christ said and he is good for us. But I think it's just important that
good point.
Paul was trying to drive home the point that God
was yep. All right, so let me read one passage to you before we quit. I need to get this in. Because I've made a big deal out of, you know, 1 Corinthians 1:16, that there be no division among you. So does Paul. He exhorts us to that. There needs to be unity. Nobody here disagrees with that. I want you to hear this. This is involving the Lord's Supper in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, beginning with verse 17. But the following instructions I do not commend you, because when you come together, it is not for the better, but for the worse. For in the first place, when you come together as a church, I hear that there are divisions among you. Not good, Paul said. And then he says, and I believe it in part. Now listen. For there must be factions among you in order that those who are genuine among you may be recognized. What is he saying there? Is there a point in time sometimes when you no longer can have a relationship with somebody that, you know, it just can't go any further? Paul says there is. Paul says there comes a point in time when there must be factions among you in order that those who are genuine among you may be recognized. When you come together is not the Lord's Supper that you eat, and so on and so on. Now, he's just trying to set them up and help them to understand that, and let me just make this point, that unity at all costs is not what Paul is saying. That's what I'm trying to get us to see. There are times you've got to draw the line in the sand. All right? Thank you.